Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, Happy New Year. How's it going? I'm at home today. I took down the tree. It's Saturday, the 6th of January. Is that too late? I wasn't really sure if it's supposed to be the 5th or the 6th, and then we'd run out of time on the 5th. So yeah, took down the tree today. So it's kind of annoying. I mean, I love having the decorations up, but then again, our tree had done good service and was kind of looking quite dead, if I'm honest with you. Like when I took the decorations off, a lot of the branches snapped and that kind of thing. But it's also quite funny because Richard and I were doing a bit of a like look around, like have we definitely got all the decorations packed up? And actually, to be honest, in our house, it's quite hard to tell. There's a lot of things that I collect that could definitely double as a decoration. But anyway, I hope everything's right with you. Hope you had a lovely Christmas, however you spent it, and New Year. We did my favourite thing for New Year. Well, I've got two favourite things. I either like to stay in or I like to do some work. Because when you're working, you get to do all the fun stuff, like be somewhere that's, you know, a bit of a happening. But also, you know, you get fed and get something to drink and transport and all the stuff that you have to worry about normally with New Year. So Richard and I did some DJing in Brighton, which was really fun. And my brother came and some friends, and my dad. So it's actually quite a sweet little night out. But apart from that, I've been very, very reclusive. I finished the tour sort of towards the end of December, and then I did one more show in Glasgow, and that was on the 16th. And then I haven't worked since then, which has been lovely. Well, I say I haven't worked since then. I've been doing bits and bobs this week because I've started the year with a very unusual thing, in that a song I sang a long time ago has re-entered the charts. And it's kind of crazy. So Murder on the Dance Floor, a song I love singing anyway and already have lots of adventures with, has now had this, I don't know, revival, I guess, because it's featured in Saltburn, which I probably told you about before Christmas. But Saltburn is a movie by Emerald Fennell, written and directed by her. And Murder on the Dance Floor is used in its entirety at the end of the movie in a way where, this isn't a spoiler, someone dances to it and they haven't got any clothes on. And the film's been a big hit and it's brought the song along with it. So how lovely, and really quite bizarre for me to be having a top 10 song in the UK that I released when I was half my age. I'm 44 now and I was 22 when it came out. That's insane, but lots of fun. So yeah, been enjoying that. Well, instead of enjoying it, it's felt surreal. It's a little bit like lockdown times, really, when I knew a lot of people watching Kitchen Disco, but I wasn't really seeing anyone. It feels very similar because I'm getting amazing, you know, facts and statistics about how the song's doing, not just in the UK, but around the world. But I'm not really seeing anyone. I'm just here with my kids, trying to sort out toys. Mickey's got his birthday tomorrow. He's going to be 5. So I've got to wrap some stuff when he goes to bed tonight and get the helium out and do some balloons for him and all that sort of stuff. And that's kind of taking up equal headspace, I would say, if not more. But also, of course, a return to the podcast, which is really lovely. And, you know, this is really glorious because I'd already recorded a load before the tour, so I feel quite like, yay, I can be hibernating, but I've also got these nice conversations to share with you. I don't know why I'm being so languid in my delivery to you. I've got 4 kids in the next door room and at some point they're going to notice I'm not there. I've sort of crept out. I love having them around. I'm kind of ready for them to go back to school now. It's been a lot of mummy, mummy. And sometimes you just, I have this vision of myself being sort of split in two or growing tentacles, or either of those would be very helpful. Anyway, this week's guest. So I first met Gabby Logan when I did a show called Name That Tune with Alan Carr. So it was a couple of years ago now. And Gabby did really well on the show. It was like a celebrity edition. So it was her and Vic Hope. And yeah, I played the piano. I'm laughing about that because it's not really something I normally do. But I was playing the piano there. And Gabby was on the show. And I just thought she gave off such a lovely energy. She seemed like such a nice woman. And obviously, I already knew a fair amount about her. I'd seen her doing her sport broadcasting. And I also knew about her podcast, The Midpoint. And I thought she seems smart and funny. And I think she's a very good broadcaster. She's really good at interviewing people. So she approached me, would you like to do my podcast? And I said, how about you do mine? So I got to have a lovely conversation with her and she came around to my house. She has twins, a son and a daughter. They're now 18. So we spoke about having kids at that age, but we also spoke about what it's like to lose someone significant in your life, because Gabby has already done a few interviews talking about her brother who tragically died when he was only 15 and Gabby was 19. And obviously that shapes your life immeasurably. And I think sometimes when they have these big events, hold on. Yes, Jess? All right, 2 seconds. Listen, I'm just recording something and I'll come and sort you out. Yes, yes, I will. I will. 2 minutes, 2 minutes.
Tell him to stop.
Who am I talking about? Mickey. Mickey, 2 more minutes. Okay. There we go. See? Oh, he's not happy with that outcome. Yes, when you have these big life events, they just change things. And I think Gabby is a very good example of someone where she's decided, well, I don't know if she's decided or it's how her instinct was, or just, you know, her emotional response was to make her life count for more because of what her brother missed out on. And, oh, for God's sake, can you hear them calling me? 2 minutes, Mickey!
What?
2 minutes, my love.
Okay, 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you. Anyway, Gabby, I'm sorry, this is a very inappropriate thing to be consistently interrupted. But there's never going to be a better time, so here I am. So I really love talking to Gabby and talking about this point in our lives as well and what it's like to be in your 40s, 50s and how you feel about yourself and what life has in store. And I read her autobiography and it's really funny. And yeah, we had such a good chat. I really enjoyed it and I'm very excited to start 2024 with my conversation with Gabby. So thanks very much for coming to find me here. I can't believe how long I've been doing the podcast now. So much fun. I've got some amazing people lined up for the rest of this series and beyond. And yeah, happy new year and I'll see you on the other side. See you in a minute. Exciting to be talking to you today, Gabby. I feel like I could spend the whole hour just talking about solely about your Freeze the Fear experience, because I watched all of that and I thought it was incredible. And I've just finished your book, which is absolutely brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I really loved it. And you made me laugh out loud a lot as well. You're a funny woman. That's good. So many things that really made me chuckle. And poor Richard, I was reading a lot of it with him opposite me. And I'd be going, oh, I just have to tell you this bit because I was laughing. But I think I'd quite like to start actually by asking you about your podcast because... You started doing your podcast, The Midpoint, around the same time I think I started doing this in 2020. Mm-hmm. So what's your relationship like with your podcast?
I started the podcast around the pandemic time, kind of early in that period, like the spring of 2020. And I'd wanted to do it for about a year before. And real life kept getting in the way and I was really busy. And then suddenly I thought, right, I've got time to do this idea, which was born out of a moment where I'd walked past a mirror and seeing somebody in the reflection that I didn't recognise inside, you know, because I had this eureka, opposite eureka moment where I went, oh, there's some, what are those lines? What is it? And it wasn't a vanity thing. It was just this inside my head. I was still this kind of mid-30s person that had loads of life ahead. And then this sparked this sudden realisation that I was what you called kind of middle-aged. I was in this midpoint of my life. And what did that mean? And was it different to all these kind of thoughts about what my parents' experience or my grandparents' experience would have been? And then I started noticing middle-aged people more, you know, kind of, it's like when you're pregnant, you notice lots of pregnant people mm-hmm. And you're kind of, your age group suddenly comes into your vision a bit more. And I realised that there's lots of different choices now in midlife to say a few generations ago, and also that people are changing careers and doing. So the initial idea was to do an inspiring podcast where people had done different things in midlife and had big decisions to make. And actually, it just morphed into something else then. And these conversations that we have around health and relationships and of course, the other conversation that has kind of spawned its own series of podcasts around menopause specifically, which when I started the podcast, Sophie, I didn't even know what really the menopause was. And I honestly had no idea that I was already experiencing perimenopausal symptoms at that point at 46, 47. So it definitely wasn't about women's health initially or those things. And I just love it. I love the chats that I have with people. And I love the freedom as well to broadcast in a way that is, you know, totally...
Yeah, it's quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, I love radio anyway. I started out in radio, but it's different, obviously, to radio. But it is certainly different to live television because you've got so much more control over the situation and who you're talking to. And also, I love the generosity of the community. You know, I have not had, honestly, in 100 episodes nearly, hardly a single knockback. You know, the person that has taken me a while to get pinned down, I've got a date for her now, is Kathy Burke. And she joked about it when I went on her podcast. She goes, I've been trying to avoid you and get to the end point, not the midpoint. She said, I thought I'd be too old now. She said it with a few expletives, but she's coming on. But it's that part of it I love. And, you know, there's this kind of mutual kind of appreciation with different podcasts and you pop onto other people's and it's lovely. I really enjoy it. And so much so, I kind of now have created a perfectly kind of isolated space in the house, which is my podcast room. And I could do other things in there, obviously, and be on other people's podcasts. But I do like going on to other people's podcasts as well, because I think there is this kind of cross-pollination in the community.
Definitely. And I wonder if as well, sometimes you start a project not quite knowing fully what it's going to offer to you. Mm. And so maybe I wonder if like, aspects of the conversations you're having is sort of giving you a little bit of a map to potential things that can happen next
totally
for you.
It was totally self-serving. It was like, okay, I'm not sure what's going on in this period of life. I'm going to ask some wise people. Mm. And so we get experts on as well. And it does offer me a kind of, you know, insights and inspiration, you know, from people's experiences and having kind of that that well of knowledge and information from people who might be a bit older or they might be really expert in a certain area. I didn't know about foods, for example, that, you know, help with kind of symptoms of menopause or foods that, you know, are much better for us as we get older and why your body reacts differently to certain foods as you get older. Suddenly you feel like you're developing allergies and actually it's not that you're necessarily getting an allergy per se, but your body just doesn't like those things as much anymore. You don't process because of your hormonal changes. You don't process food in the same way. So all those things I had no idea about, you know. Mm. And I suppose I'm quite instinctive with my body and my diet, so I would have worked it out. But it's always nice to have the science behind it, isn't it? When you hear, you know, a doctor or a nutritionist explain why you're feeling this way. So that's just one kind of little kind of snapshot of the areas that, you know, we discuss and what we talk about. Relationships, fascinating, you know, family dynamics, you know, your your one-to-one, whatever your, you know, kind of whether you're married or not, whether you're in, you know, a long-term relationship, how those all kind of change and how some people stay together through that period, other people, you know, move apart. And so it's, yeah, it is a, as you say, there's something of a map there that you can kind of see. And yeah, it's also for me, working in sport my whole life, pretty much professionally, as well as other things, I feel like I'm speaking to so many more women now. And mm-hmm. it's always been very much like, men come up to me on the street, you know, and go, oh yeah, what do you think about that game the other night? Which is lovely. But it's so nice when women come up to me in restaurants and things and go, oh, I just want to let you know, I really love that episode you did with Penny Lancaster because I was feeling like that, you know, and I kind of want to hug people, you know. This woman came up to me, this is God's Gospel, 2 weeks ago in Boots, where I live, and I was coming out the door, she was coming in, and she said, oh, hello. And she looked at me like in that way because people feel like they really know you.
Of course,
and she,
yeah.
Her eyes started filling up and she said, you've saved my life. And I was like, oh my God. She said, I was so down. I was so depressed. I had such bad anxiety. I didn't know what it was. And then I realized listening to your podcast that it was a perimenopausal symptom. I went off and I genuinely was at my absolute kind of lowest point. I didn't know what to do. I was not enjoying family life. I wasn't enjoying my work. And I just feel so liberated now because I've, you know, I've done something about it. And I've kind of, and I properly started, like, you know, greeting, as my husband would say, like my eyes were kind of filled with tears and giving her a massive hug. But it was just, I've kind of skipped out the shop going, that's just lovely, isn't it? To be able to connect with people in that way, which I don't think presenting football quite does.
Well, it gives them something, but I think that conversations, especially because you tend to listen to a podcast in a time where you're maybe having some time for yourself, maybe you're busy walking or you're, you know, traveling somewhere or you're pottering around at home and you've got, and it feels like you are the third person at the table, or I guess the fourth if you've got your expert and your guest. And I, you know, I did your podcast earlier this week, the recording, and I feel like I haven't had a lot of those things we spoke about and really spoken about anywhere else. And I think it's also really brilliant at that this stage in our lives to check in with yourself, because I think your relationship with yourself, a bit like when you said you saw yourself in a mirror and got a bit of a jolt, it can kind of be based on something that's maybe not entirely up to date with the you really are. And, you know, I've got things in my wardrobe I haven't worn now for 15 years. I probably won't revisit that, but I haven't quite let it go either. So it's about kind of keeping in step with yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think that's really healthy just to check in and with how you are emotionally, because when you get to the midpoint of your life, I remember when I hit my 40s, I said to my mum, I don't really know what 40s is. I kind of got an idea of what 30s was, but 40s, like, what's that? She said, it's, there's lots of it that's brilliant, but what you might notice is that for some people, it's a time when they might feel a bit of regret creeping in because some doors close that don't open again. So I think it's good to kind of take stock of yourself in your 40s and your 50s and just check in, because, you know, your kids are growing up if you have children, and you might be left in a chapter that you maybe haven't given yourself a lot of headspace for. And now, especially prudent, I suppose, because your children are the same age, but your children's ages.
He is technically the eldest, actually, by 20 minutes.
Yes, and actually quite crucially, as I understand it, the 20 minutes is vital, because if it had been like 25
minutes,
they would have been on different days.
Yeah. We decided afterwards, by the way, had it been, we'd have lied. We'd have just told
just
them they
simplicity.
Had the same.
Yeah. That's a very practical approach to having twins born within a very small frame of time. But I think, you know, it is a time, isn't it, when they reach, you spend, when they're born, you imagine this idea of when they're 18. It's like a bit of a drop point, isn't it? Like, you work out how old you'll be when they're 18.
Yeah.
But suddenly you find yourself, you've actually got there. And how are you finding it? How have you found it?
Yeah, it's interesting because I did exactly that. I was really, because we went through IVF to have Reuben and Lois, and I'd tried to start getting pregnant from the age of 28, which my friends were all gasping at. They thought this was terribly young and like, what was I thinking, you know? Anyway, it turned out by the time I did get pregnant, which you might have read the book, one of my best mates was already onto child three, you know, and she hadn't even been thinking about it when I was starting. So I was playing catch up then as well with a few friends, you know, in that period of life where you're going, oh, I'm 32 and I'm having them. I'm going to be 50 when they leave home. And that felt really old. But obviously then I was looking at my mom thinking, well, she was 52. And I had my first child, and you know, this generational thing where you're kind of thinking, well, am I going to be like that? She's effectively a granny, you know. My kids are just going off to. I don't think nowadays it really, everybody's so different, aren't they? And there's so many different
ways. And the generation gaps are smaller.
Yeah. So I've got to this age, and I don't feel that different to the person that gave birth to them anyway. And now we're in this is a real kind of hit home where you are in life when your first child, I know you've experienced this recently, but your first child leaves the nest because you start to see space, you start to see a bit more time, you start to see a different kind of how the future, you've thought about it, but actually now it's starting to become a reality. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that that you feel quite mournful about. And, you know, you're kind of grieving in a way a little bit the opportunities that you think, oh, have I done everything I should have done? You know, I always used to tease him because there was a period where he thought he'd be better off going to a boarding school when he was about 12. And I was like, there's no way you're going to boarding school. I said, you're not the young man that I feel I can send into the world right now. You know, you're kind of, I'm responsible for it for you. And he used to be like, well, wait, let me know where I am and I'll go. Because, you know, when they're having those kind of pushbacks against you and he thought he'd be better off living somewhere else and kind of, you know, I'd have more freedom at boarding school. I wouldn't have to, you know, live by all the things that you know.
Pretty sure they've got some rules.
Yeah,
some
exactly. Yeah, I think I don't know where he thought he was going, Hogwarts or somewhere. And anyway, he didn't go. But I used to think I had all this time that, you know, yeah. that with him. And we still have loads of time because he comes home a lot. But yeah. but it does make you see your relationship with them differently because you do have to release, you know, and let them make bigger decisions. Obviously, you're in a process of that anyway, aren't you, as a parent, where you're trying to get them to kind of make more and take responsibility. And we discussed this the other day about, you know, certain children are better at kind of handling troubles and problems. Other yeah. children, you've got to kind of, you know, you don't want to micromanage or helicopter over them, but you've got to give them a little bit more guidance on. So all of those things come into play kind of a lot more now, you know. And I love it in so many ways. It's a brilliant stage of parenting because they... when they come and talk to you, you know, he's always been a really open kid, Reuben, anyway. He tells you everything. But when they come and talk to you now, it's a much more adult basis. You know, he was discussing things like direct debits with me and things the other day, you know, stuff like that, which is, I just don't understand it, though. How does it actually happen? I don't know. You just click something in your yeah. phone and then
it's not real,
you know,
money. Yeah, don't worry about
exactly.
it.
but then Lois is still at home for at least another year. And so I'm also on the flip side of that, really trying to kind of make the most of that time, you know, when you suddenly realize that, oh my God, in a year's time, I'll have yeah. neither of my children at home all the time. And what does that mean for Kenny and I? What does it mean for even where we live? Because already the house is starting to feel too big, you know, because Reuben's a big character and he's not in it. So, but then again, he's told me that I'm not allowed to move for the next 10 years.
Oh, really?
Until he can buy the house because he never wants us to ever.
Yeah. Reminds me, I think it was my eldest son who thought that he was going to get the house when he was older. He was like, where are you guys going to go? I'm like, it's not quite. They sit down, son.
They did not say that. There's a lovely little cottage on our road and they said, you could move into the cottage on the road. We don't own it, by the way. You can move into the cottage and I'll have the house. I don't think it works like that. No. And all that kind of, I suppose it's like succession, isn't it? You know, and feeling yeah. like, you know, they're going into the world and you're changing as well. And, you know, it's exciting, but it's also, I can't tell you how many, my husband's feeling, I think, a lot more potently. He's been sending me pictures all the time randomly of when they're like six, you know. I'll just be in a meeting with somebody and I'll see these pictures pop up. I just was looking at my phone and I saw and I think he's really feeling it, you know. That yeah. kind of, that movement of time.
I do get that. I've been, so son emailed, he has moved out, but he has left a lot of his things. So I've been sort of trying to help him sort out the room a bit so that I can make it a room we can use for other people now because I really need that room back, yeah. ideally. And it's got all these little pictures from when he's small. And I did get that moment where I was like, oh, I'm actually, it's happened, you know, he's not, he might come and stay here occasionally, yeah. but this is not going to be his home anymore. And it is a bit of a shift.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not going to be that mum stood crying in her son's yeah. empty bedroom. No. Like, it's not going to be me today. But I mean, I remember even when I left home, I'd been gone a couple of years and my mum said, I moved out at 18 as well. She suddenly said, oh, I realised I forgot to teach you how to make a white sauce. You left home without knowing how to make a white sauce.
Yeah.
I was like, it's fine, mum, it's fine. but I don't think she did try and attempt to teach me actually at that point. But when you roll back, I want to go back now to when they were born. What was going on in your professional life when you had your babies?
I felt when I had them, I was kind of in what I thought at the time was the absolute best job. I was at ITV, I was the lead football presenter, and things were going really, really well. And I didn't know how I was going to keep juggling and, you know, keep everything going. But I felt it was going to be possible, you know, because I didn't have any intention of not doing what I was doing, but I knew I was going to have to modify some things in my life. So professionally, I was on a really great, you know, kind of period. It was in a great period of my life. It didn't stay like that for very long. But that was, you know, I felt like I was, I look back and realise I wasn't, but I felt quite accomplished, you know? I felt like I really knew what I was doing. And I think I probably didn't as much when I look back. I think I definitely feel much better at my job now than I was then. But at the time, I felt like a grown-up, you know?
Yeah, and that's good as well. It's good to have confidence. And when you start piling up the experience, you know, these things will count and you've learned and you've made some, you know, early mistakes and then you've progressed and you've worked with people for a few years and you start to know people. Yeah. These things do help you feel like I'm supposed to be here. But I mean, now we're really used to seeing women folk in sports and presenting. But I would imagine then this was not the case.
Well, I mean, by the time I had them, there were some more coming. But when I started out, there were hardly any women doing what I did. I mean, a couple, you know, and they were people like Sue Barker started presenting tennis at the BBC, and Claire Balding and Hazel Irvin were probably at the BBC, but not kind of on main, you know, main channel kind of broadcasting. Mm-hmm. But they were contemporaries. But at Sky, I was, you know, pretty much one of the only women at the time. And then I went to ITV and I was the only woman doing what I did and presenting live football and things. And so I think what was troubling and slightly difficult for them to deal with, I say them being some of the bosses I worked with, was, okay, it's one thing we've accepted this woman to do this job, but a pregnant woman, you know? And I think that was, even if they didn't openly say that, I think it was quite tricky to kind of handle a little bit of that. And it was certainly challenging for me anyway, because I was doing Champions League, so I was traveling around Europe doing these games. And pregnant with twins, it was quite a physical challenge. But I was determined, you know, that I wanted to kind of, you know, keep going and not use my pregnancy as a reason to shift back from what I was doing, or use, you know, kind of the whole process to say, oh, I'm just going to take a step away now, because I felt I could do it. But I did feel more under the microscope, I think. And certainly the reaction when I had Ruben and Lois, I remember a journalist writing a really nasty kind of piece about, because I was paparazzied walking them in the pram, and made this kind of connection saying that I was, you know, instead of enjoying my babies, I was out power walking to try and get rid of my baby weight or something. And it was a completely ridiculous article. And I should have, of course, I was full of hormones and emotion, should have just ignored it. But I just remember sitting on my bed thinking, how am I going to do this? Like, how am I going to please everybody? Because I think that's the thing at that time, you know, we're all a bit more susceptible to being people pleasers when we're younger. And I was like, how am I going to be a great mum? How am I going to be a great worker? You know, produce kind of the stuff that I've been doing, produce the kind of quality of work I've been doing. And, oh, be a good wife, you know. How am I going to do all these things? Oh, and stop people writing things that are ridiculous about me. Yeah. And, you know, so, and Kenny was brilliant with me about things like that. He was just like, doesn't, you know, like, you cannot for one minute put any kind of, you know, stock in what somebody like this says. You just have to have the people around you that you trust and you who understand and know you. And but you can't help, you know, I think.
No, we're all human. Yeah, also, it's all the stuff it's your inner monologue,
and
isn't it?
And your insecurities you know, what did it mean to be a working mum in that environment, and how, you know, how was I going to do all those things? So I did have some real wobbly moments in the first couple of years where I just thought, I can't do this. You know, I'm going to do something that's way more under the radar so that my mothering doesn't get scrutinized, you know, and that I don't feel that, because I didn't mind my work being scrutinized, right?
Yeah, but that's just you. You're building that.
But at this bit, I felt really exposed and vulnerable about, I think.
I wonder as well, I mean, look, we all feel an immense responsibility when you bring your baby or babies home from hospital and you are a new mum and you're responsible for this tiny person and you question so many decisions you're making and, you know, if your instincts are right. But I think sometimes if you've also come to it, these are much wanted babies, you've been through all the IVF, there's sometimes this extra thing of like the thing that you've been wanting so much and you have to protect yourself through the process. What if it doesn't happen? So sometimes when it's actually happened and the babies are there, you haven't really even allowed yourself to think about those days as much, maybe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's probably the case, isn't it, for a lot of people having babies, actually. You think about the birthing process. You don't think about what your policy is going to be when they're four on you know, homework, or what's your policy going to, you know, so all those kind of things that come into play. And I certainly hadn't really thought about how are you going to deal with, you know, if people don't, you know, think it's great to go out to work and have children and have, you know, this, how are you going to deal with criticism about the fact that you're probably going to employ somebody to help you? Because I don't live anywhere near my family, and Kenny doesn't live anywhere near his family. He lives with me, obviously, but we don't, he does, his family in Scotland, mine in Yorkshire. Every bit of help we were going to have was going to be paid for. And that is a responsibility in itself, isn't it? Because then you're thinking, oh, I've got to really make the right decision about these people and how, you know, how is that going to work? And I didn't mind that because I thought, right, you've got to be upfront about it. And not, I didn't want to be one of those people that when you do articles and interviews that you kind of make out you're doing everything. There's no way I could do everything. I was going to have somebody help me. And because Kenny wasn't going to, he just finished playing rugby, but he was going to start the next stage of his career as well. So he wasn't going to be at home all the time. We were very lucky because he was quite flexible. So he was around a lot, and especially in the early months of Reuben and Lois's life. And so we were very much kind of, you know, like most people in the first child, you're kind of juggling, aren't you? How much help does it take? You know, what's it like when your husband goes away, when you've got 2-month-old twins? Can you go 24 hours, you know, without seeing another human being? Is it possible to kind of, you know, of course you can, but, you know, it's much nicer if you do see another human being and somebody pops in for 10 minutes. So all of that, those early days, there was part of me thinking, okay, I might not be able to do this. I'll you know, do something else. I'll have to retrain and do something that's much more under the radar, so I don't feel I have to justify my decisions. And, you know, and then I was like, you've got to own it, actually.
Yeah.
That's how I kind of came to peace with it, and just being honest and being authentic and not pretending that it's anything other than a team effort. And, it, you know, and I kept in my back of my mind was always that proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah, me too. It's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah. And if I have to pay some of the members of that village, then fine. You know?
Yeah, that's so true.
They're not all going to be people in my village.
Yes. Some are on the hour and they leave, bang on at a certain time.
Yeah. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
But actually, there was a bit in your book about that stage and of early childhood. And I thought, oh, I wish I'd read that when I had my first at that stage, because you said something like that you actually were a bit, I don't know, it's puzzled by mother guilt, but it wasn't something you automatically took on with wanting to be a working mother. And you said it wasn't so much that, you know, you would have someone else doing the pureeing, but it's when you didn't actually mind that it wasn't you that had done it.
No, that's the thing. I think I came to peace very quickly with the fact that I wasn't going to be able to do everything, you know. It was more my kind of unrest, if you like, and my restlessness was more about how the rest of the world, how I was going to explain that in a way. Do you know what I mean? So I was really happy with the idea that actually Judith, who was our first nanny for a couple of years, was amazing at pureeing, right? So she was really good at that. And while she was doing that, I could then go and change the babies. And I just needed that extra, so because then I was going to be going out to do a bit of work and, you know, and so I was really happy that other people were good at other things and, you know, they could do those parts of the job. I wanted to do as much as I could, but also I had this other, Kenny was very much of the mindset that we had to look after our relationship as well, because he felt that it was really important that, you know, I don't know why he was so big on this, actually. It's really interesting.
He's right, though, isn't he?
Yeah, he was right. Yeah. But, I mean, that's also quite a challenge when you first had your babies, to think that that person is as important as, you know, as these two dependents who, you know.
It's not just that person, it's the two of you.
Yeah, it's the relationship.
Yeah. I remember after, I think it might have been after our third baby, and Richard gave me a locket with some pictures of us in it. And I said, oh, hasn't got the kids. And he went, some things are just for us.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, you're right. It's so easy to neglect that side of things. But actually, your kids love to see you happy and doing
even
things together.
Now, my kids, and they're 18, I know, even though they get a bit kind of, they do really like seeing you have affection and, you know, touching each other. And, you know, kind of if they see Kenny kind of put his hand on mine watching TV or something, or especially my daughter, she's a real romantic and she'll be like, oh, you too. But I know she really likes it. And and he always said at the very beginning, Kenny was like, look, our love is what has helped to create these babies. As it transpired, some really good doctors as well. But he said, that's, you know, and that our love is going to bring them up. And, you know, and we've got to remember that that needs work on it as well. You can't just take that for granted. So I think I was probably, I would have been a much more, well, that'll sort itself out. Do you know what I mean? And actually, no, it doesn't. Or any relationship needs work, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah.
So he was quite wise to that.
Yeah, I think that is wise. And actually, I think when I was reading a book and you said something about how you've been with Kenny over half your life, I suddenly realised with a jolt that I'd been with Richard for half of mine. And I think there's a lot of parallels, actually. And it's nice because sometimes with conversations on spinning plates, we don't really speak very much about the partners that often, to be quite honest with you. It's not always necessary, but it is nice to have a little minute to appreciate all that support that you get.
Yeah.
That gives you the freedom
to
really do what you do.
Yeah, and to give you and the confidence as well, I think, in terms of, because there's a practical side to it, you know, because there's nobody I'd rather have left the kids with any day if I was working than their father, right? So, because I know he was great with them and he would, but he couldn't always be there. But it wasn't just that practical backbone kind of support. It was also that the nurturing and confidence, you know, which sometimes you need a little kind of push to get back out there and do the things that, you know, that you did. And he was always such a big fanboy, you know, he'd be like, you're great, go, you're really great at this, you should say yes to that, or you should do something like that. And and sometimes I'd be like, well, you would say that, but actually he was completely, you know, 100% his belief, you know, that's what he felt. And so he did, at times when my confidence might have been ebbing a little bit, he did fill that gap and, you know, help me believe in myself, I think. And and I'm really grateful for having had a great relationship. And it's interesting, you know, Caitlin Moran, what she says about the kind of 50-50 split of jobs, and, you know, that pulling the sledge, and that, you know, you kind of, and when I read that, I'd been married probably for about 15, 16 years at the time, maybe even longer. And I kind of realised that subliminally I was, I suppose, at the beginning, trying to kind of explain that to Kenny as well about, you know, well, it's not me just telling you all the time. Sometimes you have to, you know, take responsibility for that. I think a lot of new mums find that thing where they have to kind of almost check in with their partner to say that they're going somewhere, whereas the partner doesn't feel the need to kind of like, you know, do the same back. And so I think early on there was that mutual kind of respect like that, you know, that he'd call it diary time. But, you know, I said, well, as we both know where we are, then we'll both, there'll never be a situation where one of us feels resentful that the other one's kind of able to just slip off and do, you know, their thing. And you both need those kind of things in your life, don't you, that fulfill you outside the relationship. But I think it's just putting all those pieces together that is very much, you know, it's our modern lives, isn't it? You know,
it is. And I think it's important as well to sort of, probably a little bit like what I was saying about the podcast and checking in with yourself with where you're at in life. I think relationships need that as well sometimes.
Yeah.
And just articulating if it's all got a little bit out of balance, because nothing's ever hunky-dory all the time, you know, and sometimes you need to just check in with each other and have those boundaries and those things that you know to put in place to get you back up to where you need to be.
Mm.
It's really important. But as I'm hearing you talk, you're so brilliant at talking about the times when you felt a bit more vulnerable. And I just wondered if that's something you always felt comfortable with, because I would imagine being someone blazing your own path in a predominantly very male environment, it might be something that you would normally try not to show vulnerability in those situations.
I would say that was probably the case until maybe about 10 years into my career, and when I'd had the kids and they were a few years old. And I started going on trips with male colleagues, as I did a lot, and realizing that when we'd finished work at the end of the day, quite a few of them wanted to talk about their families and their kids, and other things would come out. And I don't know if that was because I was a woman and that we were having more of these conversations. And I felt like actually it's okay to, you know, to show that vulnerability to them. Because I think at the beginning, you know, you wanted to kind of look like everything was in order, everything's perfect, it's all great here. There's, you know, no sign I'm gonna let you down here. I'm a safe pair of hands for you. And actually that might be true, but you could still have, you know, admissions of feeling a little bit wobbly about something or insecure about something. And I suppose it's a confidence thing as well, perversely, isn't it? Actually, the confidence to admit that. And
that's
then,
very true, actually. That's definitely something that happens when, as you get a bit more secure in yourself, you feel able to say bits when you're not feeling as confident.
Yeah, and I think also the women in my industry, that as in early on, there was this outside kind of force, they putting this kind of pitting you against other women that you know, oh, there's another woman coming on doing,
same in music,
you know,
exactly.
And
same thing.
I think, like, I didn't start this competition.
No.
I mean? And also, there are loads of men, right? So why can there only be one woman here? Like, you know, there's room for both of us. And once you get over that and you start to, and I think quite quickly I realized, like, this is somebody else's problem, not mine. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And also realizing that you can then turn around and help those people and new people coming in and give people advice if they ask for it. And there's room for loads of people to do the job. Then I think at that point you feel a lot more likely to admit those feelings of vulnerability. And, you know, there's a colleague who's going to have a baby very soon. And I just felt, I don't know her that well, but I just felt she's done amazingly well in the last few years, that I don't know why I needed to text her, but I just sent her and said, look, I know you might be feeling like, how am I going to do this job with, but, you know, you will. And I thought maybe I'm overstepping the mark. And she sent back a lovely message just saying thank you, because I know there haven't been many of us who've been visibly pregnant doing this job and also bringing babies to work and things like that, which I never did. But now what I'm so pleased is that people feel confident to do that. We had Ellen White, who was the Lioness's top goal scorer, was our pundit this summer. She breastfed her baby in the green room all the time. Like, she was running off sets. And she wasn't at all apologetic about that. There was no sense of her feeling like, well, as there shouldn't be, like, you know, why should I not do this? I thought, wow, that is progress. Because, you know, while I might have been pregnant, I certainly would never felt the confidence that I could have walked onto set with my babies. You know, that was a whole different level of kind of progress, if you like. So
definitely.
I think it's great that, you know, not only are more women in my industry feeling they can be pregnant at work and visibly, you know, visibly so, talk about football with a baby bump, they can then feel, well, actually, I need to bring the baby on this job. So I know Natalie Pinkham, who presents Formula One, at the beginning, her mum would travel around with her on the grid, you know, Formula One grid with her baby. And and so, you know, otherwise women are going to just disappear if we can't do that. You know, they're not going to be visible at all in the industry. They're just going to get to a certain point and have to, you know, stop doing what they do, which seems like a real waste.
Yeah, a waste, but also, as you say, it's not necessary. And
no.
I think we've realised that, I think the whole image, in fact, of motherhood has changed massively in the nearly 20 years since I've been a mum.
Yeah.
I just feel that we've got a lot more used to seeing women with all the needs that they might feel put upon them by motherhood, and their work, and much more open dialogue, much more ways to do it, more options for how it might look like to you. You don't have to have a one-size-fits-all way of dealing with these things.
No.
And it's, you know, everybody's kind of paving the way for the next one. A bit like we were saying about women being slightly pitted against each other in the workplace. It's such an old trope. I do think it's fading away now, but it was exactly the same in music.
Mm.
Late 90s, early noughties, very, very similar. You were encouraged to sort of look at each other kind of side on, really, which is not really very healthy.
No,
and also not how you feel. You know?
No.
I love spending time with other women.
Yeah, and you don't want to get into that at all, because then you're answering questions or you're saying things, you're like, well, this is not actually how I feel at all. This is your opinion, so I'm just going to let this go. And, you know, and as I say before, there's a lot of room for other people, and you know, and it's great for, I think, anyway, I'm quite one of those people that I know it's really hard staying at the top of your industry and your job, and you've got to work hard all the time. So the idea that you're going to somehow get a dream job and then just sit back with you, put your slippers on, and, you know, other people coming into the industry, they want your job. That's, everybody does. Do you know what I mean? That's, yes. That's not just one woman. That's like, you know, everybody wants, you know, to do those things. Yeah. So I feel like I would always just want to do the best I can, whether or not they're deciding to pit somebody else against me. And you also, you grow a thicker skin to those things.
When, definitely.
You know, so it doesn't penetrate and worry you in the same way that it might.
Oh, cheers to that. So I said your book made me laugh a lot, but it's also responsible for making me cry as well. You write so movingly about, I have to ask you about Daniel, and it's one of those things where I'm looking at you talking and I'm thinking, she looks so happy and I want to ask her a brother and it's going to make her sad, but I know that that's not how grief works, that's not how losing someone you love works. You don't need me to remind you about Daniel. And you write about him so beautifully. I wonder if I could just ask you a little bit about what he was actually like.
Well, it's such a long, it's 1992 when he died, and you know, we were talking before about kind of walking past a mirror and seeing yourself as a certain way and feeling different inside. And of course, he's forever frozen in my mind as this beautiful 15-year-old who's about to be 16. And sometimes I've tried to imagine him older because there's a very strong look in the boys in our family. So I think I've got an idea roughly what he would look like. Yeah. But when you say his name, immediately he's that fresh-faced, you know, gorgeous 15-year-old. And he was such a positive, happy, healthy, you know, really popular, brilliant at football, had just signed for Leeds United. He was going to be a professional footballer. He was 2 months away from realising his dream. Just incredibly well-liked and at ease. You know, when there's people that's just at ease. I never had any, like we have, you know, we all have sibling moments with four of us before he died. And it was more me and my sister would have little kind of fights and stuff. And he always seemed to be the person that was on, I don't know, he just seemed to be in the right. Do you know what I mean? Everybody kind of wanted to be around him. And he was just set for a great life, you know. And at 19 years old, as I was when he died, I hadn't felt the need to spend every minute with him until he died because I didn't know he was going to die. So it's so kind of like, I look back now and think, oh, the year before he died, I left home for a year. I went to have a gap year. I should have stayed at home for that year. If I'd known he was going to die, I would have been at home every day and spent every minute so I could answer your question more fully and tell you exactly what he was like, you know. But I kind of knew this teenager who lived in the house with us. You know, I didn't know.
Reason to think anything
and
happen.
Of course, all those questions when he died, my mum, who was living obviously at home with him, even they didn't know, you know, he had this girlfriend, but was she really his girlfriend? You know, what kind of relationship had they, you know, all those things that you kind of just evolve because you don't think your teenager's not going to be with you the next day. So, he was just a great kid.
Well, I'm so sorry that you've had to go through losing him because you basically had to live through what everybody has as their nightmare. It's getting that phone call that changes everything. And I think when you have, well, anyone significant in your life, there's a bit of it in your peripheral because you know it happens sometimes. Mm. And then when you have a child, it's the, you know, the peripheral moves in a bit more. Mm. And you think, I don't know, sometimes I'll be like, is this the day that everything flips? But my heart just goes out to you and your family for having to go through all that and navigate that new reality. Mm. And when you have children, it always causes you to think a little bit about the dynamic in your family and what traits come from who, but it also makes you think about significant moments. And so there must be two, one that's yet to happen and then one that already has. So the yet to happen is, I suppose, your children reaching the age that everything changes for you. And then also you've had to go through the point of them being 15 and seeing what that looked like, but then turning 16. So when your children are small, the whole thing we're encouraging to think is the world is wide and your life is ahead of you and everything is out there. So how have you been able to sort of navigate having lived experience of when that next bit doesn't happen?
Yeah, I didn't realise how impactful and how significant that age would be when Reuben was about to turn 16. So Reuben's birthday is in July and it was obviously GCSE year. So he was doing his GCSEs and I kind of realised on Daniel's anniversary that year, which is in May, oh gosh, this is about the same, because Jordan, Jordan's my other brother, Daniel's birthday was also July. They were like 3 days apart from each other in their birthdays. Wow. And so in that May, I thought, oh, this is now almost the exact day kind of thing that he was away from being 16 as Reuben is. And it really did kind of hit me how we were going to cross over, you know, a threshold that he didn't. And also there were similarities. He was very accomplished in his sport, Reuben, and he wanted to be a professional rugby player. And so there were so many kind of parallels there as well. And then I kind of had to realize, you know, do I treat him? Am I treating him subliminally differently as well? You know, it was different, I think, with Lois because of that, the male kind of thing. But, you know, it was the same kind of, he was a boy and he was a son. And,
yeah, it's
you know,
completely natural
my parents'
to do that.
Relationship with their son. And I talked to Kenny about it. And I actually talked to Reuben about it as well because I was aware that maybe I'd treated him differently. You know, had I subliminally kind of prepared myself for some kind of disappointment or some kind of, you know, experience that, you know, was inevitable? Was it, you know, was this kind of, you know, I don't think I'd thought about it in those terms, but I think when, and also then understanding even greater my parents' grief, because, you know, it's that person on the edge of adulthood and where they're going and their possibilities and all of those things that, you know, conversations you're having with your teenagers about their futures and, you know, and
it's immense, isn't it?
Yeah, what they want to do and where they want to go and, which we were having with Reuben and seeing that through my parents' eyes again. You know, I understood it, of course, when he died, how horrific it was for a parent to lose a child, but I think it came back again in a different way. And because even when I had them, I had another feeling like that. You know, when they were born, yeah, I suddenly realized that love and that relationship and how, you know, how impossible it is to kind of put yourself in that position. And that period of time. And then even more kind of bizarrely, a few months later, because of his sport, Reuben was asked to go, all the players at his club had to have heart screening because he played at a certain level of rugby.
And that was something they were already doing?
Well, they must have just started doing this in the previous few years, and they all had to go in to get a kind of, make sure their hearts were. And of course, on the form he's filling in, is there anybody in the family who's had a heart? You know, my brother had a thing called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It was instant death, basically. No warning sign, just the heart collapses and he died on the spot. And when Reuben was writing kind of the form and I was helping with the form, I'm like, God, they're going to read this form and think, like, what? and it wasn't genetic what happened with Daniel. So there was no reason why Reuben would. But they did take extra care and look, you know, kind of make sure the screening was really looked at and whether he'd need more screening. But there was nothing there at all. So it was just a complete aberration with Daniel. But even that, I thought, well, this is progress, you know, because had Daniel had that a few months before he died, we would have known then that his heart was already showing these signs of being, you know, kind of very damaged, even though he hadn't shown any signs as a person at all, you know. Mm. So he could go for a 10-mile run, he slept well, he ate well, he looked great. So there was nothing outside that was showing us. So yeah, it was a very strange period, actually. And it did help me understand my parents dealt with his death in very different ways. And it helped me understand my dad a bit more, I think. And, you know, I always felt immense sorrow for him and compassion for him, but it probably deepened, I think, at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when the wheel turns, how your perspective shifts around and you step into different shoes for that bit and you're like, oh, I can see it's the parent now. Mm. Start to touch the edges of what they went through as well. But anyway, I'm just sorry that it happened. I think it's the bit where you write about him, especially when you're with him after he's died and you're speaking to him, and it was just the simplicity of saying I loved him so much. And of course love doesn't stop when someone's not here, it just sort of takes on a new shape. And I guess you almost kind of have to put a bit of him in you, carry him with you, and then the legacy is that you carry them, you live, the best outcome of that pain, I think, is to try and live your life in the fullest way to honour the fact that they didn't get that opportunity, and also because that is what they would want.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what my immediate reaction was. You know, I went off to university and I became this kind of, like, you know, carpe diem times 100. I'm going to do everything and I'm going to, you know, make sure that I'm going to live my life. I think I was already a kind of go-getting, kind of busy person, but I was really going to do everything I possibly could to live the fullest life I could. And not only that, I was going to tell other people to live their life kind of fully. And then I realized after about a year, I kind of crashed a bit and realized I needed to get some help because I hadn't really processed his death in the way that I needed to. Mm. I'd just been running like this, you know, really big ball of energy that wanted to do loads of things and have him completely at the front of my mind all the time when I was doing that. But I also needed to deal with it in a different way because I don't think that was going to be healthy long term.
Grief isn't always chronological. And it morphs depending on what else is going on around you and where you're at and what you're processing. So
yeah, and who you're with and, yeah. You know, and I think, you know, I've seen that in my own family, how everybody has dealt with it so differently.
Yeah.
And there is no right or wrong way. Definitely I mean, eventually there is a way that, okay, that those behaviours are quite unhealthy. And if you want to live a better life, you're going to have to do something about this, you know, yeah. Because you can take grief and it can become a really destructive ally, you know, that doesn't help you at all.
Yeah.
Or it can be, you know, something that you can use in a positive way to try and inspire you and try and live in that person's or give that person's memory a really, you know, kind of positive reflection. And when, you know, you look back, you know, obviously over your life, I'd prefer to feel like that, you know. And I think in my parents I saw two different ways of dealing with it. And also what it made me realize is you can't make somebody grieve in a, you know,
no.
I've been asked like, how would you give people advice about that? And I just think you've got to just be there for people and yeah. try and, you know, try and listen and try and help. And when they ask for help, maybe then, you know, then there are things that will help them. But I've had this woman called Julia Samuel on my podcast a few
times.
That's
so funny. You mentioned how she's literally in my mind while you were talking.
Really?
Yeah.
And she, I think, she writes brilliantly on grief. And I found her, I've had her on as a special episode, actually, about grief. And then I've read her books. And I really kind of, everything she says, I think, makes a lot of sense about grief, you know, in terms of how people react, obviously, so totally differently, and how, you know, how it can be, how you can help, you know, you can help people, but it's not an exact science.
No, and I think you have to be very forgiving with yourself too, because sometimes the reality of the fact that it's just something really shit that happened, it's like just going to be, that's what we're going to be looking at for a little minute, but
I think, and also, I think for me, when I was younger, because I was so young when it happened, you know, 19, I think I thought at that point that, you know, things like that were going to happen to me all the time.
Exactly.
You know, this is, okay, shit stuff's going to happen a lot. And so really protect yourself against it, you know, the world. Yeah. And actually, you know, don't let anybody really in because, you know, you don't want to be too open to that disappointment again. And I had to learn, you know, to feel emotion in a different way and not be so kind of hardened to life because otherwise, you know, I was going to get hurt, you know. And I think that's what happened with my dad in lots of ways because he just felt he couldn't love, you know, again, you know, in anybody because he was going to be hurt again. And that was hard to see, I think, especially for my younger brother, who was only 6 at the time.
Oh, so, yeah, that is hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the concentric circles. It affects everything there.
Yeah,
after,
the ripples go on and on because obviously, you know, I'm fascinated in kind of how patterns repeat as well and how family, I don't mean in terms of deaths, but in terms of behaviours.
Absolutely.
And how you can break that, you know, it's not a fait accompli that your family is like this, do you know what I mean? Or this is what we, you know, that you can help and change that direction, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it also helped when I met Kenny, we were in our mid-20s, he had lost his cousin who was like a brother to him when he was similar age. His cousin was a lot older. His cousin was in his early 30s and left 2 small children. Again, it was a tragic accident where he, you know, he was alive and healthy in the morning and he was dead 24 hours later. And I think because he'd experienced this sudden, horrific, you know, loss, he was very understanding, I think, of how that changes you, but also how you live with that. And, you know, he was very openly emotional about his cousin in a way that, you know, I had not really seen. Kind of, I've been near somebody since my brother had died that was very tuned into that, you know, I think.
Yeah, which allows you to be able to talk about it as well.
Yeah,
it doesn't become this scary topic to bring up when it's in your mind anyway.
Yeah.
Ages ago, I spoke to Mary Berry, who lost her son in a car accident, and she said,
that it did. She said she found her way to deal with her grief, but one thing she found she really struggled with was actually other people getting very dramatic and annoyed and wound up about small things in life. She's like, oh, you've obviously never had anything like this happen to you. Yeah. If you can let yourself get in a state like that, that's something as inconsequential as that. Yeah. It's the only flicker of anger.
Yeah, no, I wrote about that as well in my books. When I went to university, I would be, especially my first year at university, I was fresh off this experience, basically. You know, he died in the May and I'd gone to university in the October, and I was totally bemused by people that would be annoyed by not being able to get the accommodation they wanted in their second year. You know, the flat wasn't going to be quite as nice as the other, you know, like properly, you know, having meltdowns about it. And I was going, what is the problem? What is your problem? Internally, I was saying this to myself because it was internal monologue. And I had to really take a step back after a few months and realize that the other people's shit and their problems was actually permissible. That was their problems. It was okay. And I could, you know, I didn't have to grade it all. I had to, you know, otherwise I was going to find life tough.
Yes.
Because everybody was going to be quite, you know, because people generally in life, thankfully, what happened to us doesn't happen to, you know, to every family on the street. And that's great, because you don't want that kind of, you know, tragedy to befall people. But they will experience in their life disappointment, but it might not be to that extent. So I had to learn how to kind of process that, you know, so that I could be an empathetic, kind friend.
Yes.
While at the same time.
I'm gritting
your teeth. Yeah. It's going to be all okay. You know that, don't you? It's going to be fine. Yeah.
I can understand why you feel like your life is over.
I think it's the same thing happens.
Because you've got to be in your essay, whatever it might be.
When you have kids, you have to remind yourself, don't you? Like when my son first had heartbreak with a girl when he was 15, I had to really stop myself going, oh my God, you'll so get over this. And you'll be like...
No, their problems are huge.
Yeah, because he was such a poet about it, and he kind of had to have a day off school and said to me... Yeah, he said,
wow,
there is a space here where my heart was and it is empty, and I, when does this feeling fill? And he was properly like... really heartbroken. And my husband and I, Kenny had to sleep with him the first night. He won't mind me saying this now, Reuben, because he said, I can't imagine like falling asleep and how I'm going to feel when I wake up. And he,
oh wow,
I know. And it was,
I mean, it's lovely that he feels he can love that fully.
Oh, I mean,
it's an amazing thing.
All in at 15 years old, you know. and so I was, after a few days, going to Kenny, like, at what point? I mean, I think a girl wolf whistled at him on the Tuesday at school, and he came home skipping. He was
fine.
He was fine after 5 days. But and when I told him it might be a week, he went, a week? And he said, every song on the radio reminds me of her. Every song is written to me. They're all writing songs to me. I remember him saying that, and I just, inside I was sniggering, because I remember thinking, I remember that feeling.
So like, do I. I really remember that feeling.
Where you go, how does she know to write this song?
Yes, oh my God, they're speaking to me. Yeah. This is amazing.
But you can't obviously belittle those experiences, can you? As a parent, you have to fully, you know, kind of embrace their,
oh, yeah,
you know,
it's,
their
if
emotions.
If it's real to them, it's that's just it. And minimizing or dismissing it only means they won't come and talk to you about it, no matter what it is. So, yeah, you have to let it be as big as it is. But it's also, you know, you reflect back on when you did that same thing. And you think, I mean, thank goodness there's music there, because music gives them that blare out, you know, all by myself or whatever it might be for their bedroom. Whatever the modern day equivalent is of that, I'm not even sure. But I think those things are important. But thank you for talking to me about Daniel, because it seems such a keystone moment for you in terms of the before,
seminal.
The after. Yeah, absolutely huge. And
I think because you... I think I was an age which was so pivotal anyway at 19, and such changes kind of going on
and
in your
still,
life, and
neurologically,
still teenage brain still
developing.
Kind of developing, and and all those things. So, so when I sat down to write my book, I could only start there. I sat down and thought, well, this is the day I have to kind of start from, because even though there is a before, which I'll write about, it very much was where everything changed, and where I think I really started to grow as a person and learn a lot in those years that I wouldn't want my kids to have to go through to learn in life. But I value now more than I think I realized at the time, you know, that those experiences actually gave me a lot of human kind of capabilities. And and you don't want to say kind of, you know, that like, but there was, in a way, there were some kind of superpowers that I, you know, kind of experience that I didn't know at the time were giving me qualities. And, you know, it sounds like I'm kind of glorifying, you know, his death in a way, but it, I think I learned so much. I think that's what probably, I really learned a lot. And
I hear that. I don't hear it like you're glorifying. I hear it like you're saying that it was
you know, had such magnitude, but it also is the making of you, because it had to make you, you know, you had to work on so many aspects of yourself to be able to survive it, but then to actually excel as well.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot. And that's emotional, that's layers upon layers, when in the middle of it, there's something so raw. And for your, lots of things happened to me around that time. I didn't experience grief like that, but things that happened that still I refer back as being a really pivotal moment. Mm. And your kids will have something, their version of it.
Yeah.
Whatever it may be, a trip they go on, someone they meet, someone who breaks their heart, a business thing they start that fails, whatever it might be, there will be their version of actually looking back that changed everything.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't deal with anything afterwards the same if I hadn't gone through that.
Yeah.
It's kind of...
And like you say as well, I think even though, you know, it's 31 years ago now, it's a long time, because I really don't mind talking about him. And I don't mean that in a way that I feel like it's, you know... That obviously he wasn't known, he wasn't a famous person, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a headline-making person, but I'm so proud of who he was that I don't mind talking about him. And I also talk to my kids, you know, my kids will talk about him. And I think that's important in our family as well, to keep that, you know, that memory alive. But I think it's more reflective of kind of what grief is as well, and how you can get over things that are really, really bad and disappointing. And, you know, I mean, disappointing is a mild way of, you know, expressing that, but, you know, that won't always happen to people. It won't be a death, it'll be something else, as you say. And actually, I think that's why I don't mind talking about it, because I think it's important that people, you know that, you know, that they can come through something. And I've seen it in the last couple of years with friends who've suddenly lost their partners and things, and, you know, and I see that depth of grief, and I just kind of want to put my arm around and go, you'll get there, it'll be different, but you'll get there. But I know at the beginning you can't say that to somebody, because they just not ready to hear that they'll get there, you know, and you see the different stages they're going through, and it's tough, you know. It's never an easy kind of transition for people.
No, and I think also it's nice to talk about him, because if I lost anybody I cared about that much, I'd want everybody to know their name. That would actually really matter to me. I'd be like, let's say their name. Mm. You know, I think that's something you can give people who aren't here anymore. Just that moment, like, they existed, they walked this earth, they were here. Let's acknowledge that. Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. And as I said, I'm just sorry you had to go through any of it. I do want to talk to you about something that's a complete change in subject, because I'm slightly fascinated by the fact that you did a lot of rhythmic gymnastics. I think that's so cool. Like, I know it hasn't had much in the way of, like...
airtime.
Yeah, but I think if the internet had been around then, I think, because Instagram loves a rhythmic gymnast.
It does. And when you get into the algorithm of, you know, which me and my sister, she lives in the States now, and she was a rhythmic gymnast too, and she'll send me little clips and go... And I said to her, imagine if we'd had the internet when we were kids.
Yeah.
Because we used to watch old VHSs of Russian gymnasts and stuff and wear the tape out. We would just be watching routines all the time. And even my old rhythmic gymnastic pals, you know, one of whom I played golf with this morning, we still go, oh my God, was that the sport we did? Like, we kind of like, you know, we love it. Yeah.
So cool. And it brings such joy. Yeah. I love watching it. And also when you were describing the outfits you would wear, the leotards with things stuck on and sprayed on, I thought, I'm pretty sure I've won some of those in auctions on eBay. So after we finish chatting, you should come and look. I'm pretty sure I've got some of your old outfits.
Honestly, my sister and I, my mum must have just thought we were like, what are they doing on the kitchen table? We would, because the best leotards seem to be in other parts of the world. Like, the leotards we could get in the UK were just never as good. So we would try and replicate them with glitter and, you know, marker pens and various, of course, and dyes and all sorts. We weren't allowed to have adornments on the leotards.
Right,
but
noted.
Obviously, as in, they weren't allowed to flap or anything.
Fair enough.
Yeah, which my mum thought was, you know, terrible. She would have loved us in more marabou, a lot of diamante. She would have loved a cape, you know. But we were desperate to kind of replicate those. And then we would dye our ribbons, and we would, you know, my mum would go to her laundry and be like, what has gone on here today? Who's been in the washing machine? And my sister and I were just like, you know, we loved it. It was but it was weird, because on the one hand, you know, we kind of, the sport part of it was really important, you know, which we love, the training and everything. But the great thing about rhythmic is it's unashamedly kind of showy as well, you know? And that, all that part of it was great. So you kind of like, you're kind of crossing over slightly into showbiz, you know?
Definitely. I'll say.
It's sport meets showbiz.
There you go. It set the tone. It's literally been life thereafter.
Yeah. Why are football kits so plain?
It's true. Yeah.
Why do they not have more diamantes on them?
That would be, imagine that. Yeah, they could have anything on there.
Yeah, the lionesses should have like little kind of strips of kind of little rhinestones or
yeah, that would be good. I'm going to suggest that. Well, thank you. I mean, honestly, I love that so much. When I was reading, I was like, I just want to watch the routines now.
But it's the music as well, because when we did it, you were only allowed one instrument, so most people had piano.
Oh yeah, that brilliant story about the guy.
About the guy with the harmonica. Yeah, I ended up going to this guy's house, a little terrace house in Leeds, because he played the harmonica with my cassette recorder, recording him play the harmonica for me for my routine. My mum outside in her Ford Cortina going, what's going on in that house when my daughter plays £10 to some bloke to play the harmonica? I mean, you know, you couldn't make it up with me putting a postcard in a shop window. Anybody play the harmonica?
Just then, your average.
And then sitting
then.
Through hours and hours, I was about 15, of John Williams cassettes, because he was a brilliant classical guitarist and he played his albums would just be the guitar, so I could just get guitar music off it. And I loved that part of it. It was a strange but good way to spend your 15, 16 year old kind of years, I think. It was, yeah, it was fun.
And if you ever hear music now, do any of the little moves come out?
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't go as far as you and Strictly, but I hear my routine, Strictly routine music.
Takes you right back, doesn't it?
Well, I did a jive to Elton John's Saturday.
Good
Saturday
one.
Night, yeah. And so whenever that comes on, Kenny goes, right, come on, everybody, clear the kitchen. She's going for it.
And you still remember it?
Yeah, but in the last, I need to look back at it, because I've started to kind of like realise I'm starting to forget it. You know, I used to know.
Didn't you do it in like 2007 or something?
Yeah, so it's a long time ago.
but
the jive was still, you know, kind of, Kenny's the same, because he went a lot further than me. So he'll be like, we'll be driving along and suddenly a mute piece, he'll go like this with his arm. I'm now putting my arm out and a Strictly kind of, he'll go, oh, do you remember I did my rumba to this?
Wow.
And I have those flashbacks with gymnastics music, certainly. But it's more things like Tchaikovsky and, you know.
Just a really good harmonica.
Yeah, some good harmonica music.
Well, I there's so many other things I could ask you about, but I feel like I've taken a lot of your time, so I'm just going to pick two things. I do want to ask about the Freeze Your Fear. Mm. How did you find that experience with Wim Hof?
I didn't know what at all I was getting myself into, because they deliberately didn't tell us. You know, they didn't.
Oh, one of those.
Yeah. So they said,
I can look surprised on telly, I promise. You can tell me what I'm supposed to do.
Well, they said Wim Hof, you see. So I thought it was going to be all, you know, they're going to be some cold. I thought maybe some ice baths maybe, but not the level that we went to. And I certainly didn't foresee the height stuff happening. Mm. But I understand why that was so important, because it's all about, for me, that was about how you can put blockages in your mind about things and tell yourself that you're not something, you know. And I told myself that I was scared of heights, and it transpired. There I was 2 days later, kind of forward abseiling down a mountain, and, you know, standing on the edge of a cliff doing a yoga pose, or eventually jumping off a 400-foot bridge, which I would never in a million years have done had something not happened in that process over those 3 weeks where I'd released those blockages. And I think for me, why that was important was, it might not be heights, you know. It might be that you tell yourself that you're not the kind of person that goes, and I don't mean me necessarily, but in life, that I can't do that job because I'm not that kind of person. I'm not the kind of person that does running, or I'm not the kind, you know. And I think we tell ourselves these kind of messages sometimes that can be quite harmful, you know. And I don't mean that in a, you know, harmful, they're not going to kill you, but they're going to inhibit and they're going to stop you in life doing things that are exciting and interesting. And then you can pass those on to your kids as well, if you're not careful, you know, those kinds of limiting behaviours. So, and I'd hoped I had never done that with my kids, but I definitely, through doing this, realised that, you know, that even subliminally, sometimes you can have those conversations. So that was amazing to do. But the whole breathing process I found extraordinary.
That sounds so intense. Yeah. Unexpectedly.
Really unexpected. Yeah. I mean, we walked into that tent that day expecting to lie down, have a nice lie down for about 10 minutes, and, you know, instead had these unbelievably real kind of experiences that were obviously through the mind, but the breathing took you into this place. You know, it was like, I'm not somebody who has done magic mushrooms or, you know, those kinds of things, but I imagine this is what a trip feels like. You know, and that's
so sort of vivid and psychedelic.
So vivid. I mean, to the point where how I kept saying to Tamsin Athwaite was doing the show with us, and this experience had led me to, her mum had died not long before. I didn't know much about her at all, but I knew her mum had died. So it wasn't a great surprise in the sense that I knew her mum had died, but this woman was telling me that she was her mum and that she had all this love she had to give her. And it was so strong. I was in tears when I was doing this breathing, but it was so strong. It was like, if love was a glass, do you know what I mean? It was like, it was so real that I could almost touch it. And when I was lying there, I was kind of thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to get up in a minute because I'm going to have to give her this love that her mum just keeps telling me she's, you know. And so when we stood up, Tamsin hadn't had the same kind of experience. And she was slightly kind of going, what was all that about the breathing? And then she looked at me and just burst into tears because she saw me crying. And I put my arms around her and I was like, your mum's here and she just loves you so much. And she was like, whoa, like that was, and I felt, there was part of me that just felt completely stupid even saying that, you know. And Lee Mack was the host of the show. And he said to me afterwards, when you did that, he said, we were watching you on the monitor. We were going, okay. Gabby's just, he said, I've known you for a long time. He said, and I kind of couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I said, I couldn't believe what I was feeling. It was this such a real experience of this love. And as well as having all these other kind of incredible insights into, like, I felt like I could see my body inside, like I could see the blood running through my veins. And what transpired was that he'd not just done like three rounds of breathing.
Put something in your drink?
Yeah.
It was magic mushrooms.
He was blowing stuff through the airwaves. But he'd done like 10 rounds of breathing. Normally you do like two or three to relax and feel kind of chilled. And sometimes your fingers tingle. Most times your fingers tingle and your feet tingle.
Yeah.
But he'd gone really deep. So it was like, typical, taking it that next level. And that was what I took from the breathing, though, was just how powerful breathing like that can be in terms of relaxation, deep detoxifying. It's really amazing for your system to have that breathing. And what I loved about the show as well was that when I talked about it to people, breathing and cold showers are free. So I wasn't coming out of a show going, well, what you need to do is you need to go to Whole Foods and you need to buy about 4,000 pounds of herbs. And, you know, this was stuff that anybody could access, you know, and do and change. Like, ever since then, my husband's done cold showers every day. He's really turned on to that and really helps lots of things, including psychological as well as physiological things, you know, inflammation and things. And so I learned a lot, actually. I was the right point in my life. I was 48 when I did it, and it was kind of like a good time to do something like that and just shift my mindset on something and see things differently. I think I was probably a little bit more cynical about, you know, what was he doing? What's this guy with the beard and the big poncho? What's he up to? And, you know, he lives and breathes it, obviously. That is his passion. But I think you can do it in small doses. You know, you can dip into that world and get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how powerful it was. And I funnily enough, I watched the show thinking, I don't like cold. I don't like cold showers. I don't like all that. But I actually feel like maybe that could be something quite good for me because I don't
do it. That's part of the reason why it works. I had a psychoanalyst. No, he's a professor of extreme and adverse conditions at Portsmouth University. And he was analysing the psychological, physiological and pathological responses from adverse conditions. And he said one of the things about cold water is that it's not just the physiological, so it obviously does help with inflammation, but because you're putting yourself through something that's tough, it's what it does to you mentally in terms of telling yourself kind of that you've gone through this, and that fortitude and that experience is actually really strong as a mental strength kind of builder, if you like. And doing something that's tough, I think, is actually quite good for you, you know, to push yourself sometimes out of your comfort zone is a good thing. And especially when you get to a certain stage of life where you might have decided you don't think you can anymore, you know, and it might then take you somewhere. I do a bit of cold water swimming on Sundays at a lake near me. And one of the women I swim with, you know, that's her big thing, I think, that she used to be a stunt woman.
Oh, wow.
And so she's in her mid-40s and she, I think, doesn't like the idea that she won't keep pushing herself. Because as a stunt woman, you imagine that's kind of what, you know, you might have a certain mindset. but I see that with the other women who swim there. And it is mainly women because Kenny keeps asking to come. And I'm like, I don't think you're actually banned. But you'd be in a minority and you might feel. And we were saying the other day, my friend of mine's got a husband, does a male swim club at where they live. And I do think there's something else about the community aspect of it that's really important.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Hmm. Well, you've done so many amazing things in your career, but actually the thing I wanted to ask you about, just because it's sort of another one of my... So if I go to a comedy club and I'm watching a comedian on stage, I feel like if I catch eye with them directly, I might quantum leap and find myself on stage having to do stand-up. But you actually had to live that experience when you did stand-up. I think it was in 2012.
Yeah.
And I just wondered how you found the experience of having to actually go on stage in a comedy club, because I think that sounds sort of simultaneously like slightly exciting but also terrifying.
It was one of the most... terrifying and physically, like, you know when people say they're so nervous that it manifests itself in all kinds of ways, whether you start getting really sweaty or you're, you know, you have a headache, you maybe need to go to the toilet more than you normally would, all those things that happen to you. I mean, it really was profoundly horrible, that feeling. But what was lovely, when before I went on, I was doing this thing for Comic Relief, Sport Relief, where it was five sport-related people, including Tyson Fury and Michael Vaughan, who all had volunteered, I was one of them, to learn to do a stand-up comedy routine with a comedian as your patron-like. So mine was Paddy Kilty, who was training me. And backstage, people like Jason Manford, all these amazing comedians who were used to places like the O2, and, you know, we were at the Bloomsbury Theatre, which I think is about 400 to 500 people. They were all in the same state. So these guys have been doing it for years. They've been doing comedy for, you know, in front of thousands of people, but they still got into that. They were still really nervous, you could tell.
I don't know if that's reassuring or worse.
Well, it kind of reassured me that actually it doesn't matter how, you know, how amazing you get at this, you still got that edge. But as soon as you go on stage, and the first joke has landed, it is like a drug. Like, you literally are looking for the next laugh. And then you totally get why they do it. Because you're like, wow, that was such a powerful connection. I mean, it must be when you're on stage singing and you performing and you just know the audience is totally with you. If you're at a festival or something and they're totally in your, you know, thrall, basically. They're loving what you're doing. And
it's very powerful. Yeah. But I also try and do jokes in between songs. And if they all laugh, oh my gosh, I'm cloud nine.
Yeah, if I'm hosting like a corporate awards or something and I throw a joke in and the audience like it, you know,
that's so good. It's
such a lovely feeling, isn't it? It's one of the greatest things to make a room full of people laugh. And so I came off stage and I knew it had gone well. You know, I could tell it had gone well. I ended up winning. I got given my trophy by Claudia Winkleman, which was like, fantastic. And I got home that night and I remember sitting on the kitchen worktop. We live not far from where we are now. And there's a little chip shop at the bottom of the parade and we got chips on the way home. We sat on the kitchen worktop and I had my little trophy and my bag of chips. And I was saying to Kenny, I think I want to do this the rest of my life. I was like, totally. Like, I was, 39? I said, this is all I want to do. This is what I want to do. And he's, so because we discussed earlier on, he's like, do it. Go for it. I went to bed writing new routines. I was going to, like, you know,
wow.
I was like, oh, and then I woke up in the morning. I went, I've got a mortgage. I've got, you know, I've got school run. I've got stuff to do. I've got real life. And there's a bit of me that kind of thinks you should have just at least kind of kept going as a hobby. Do you know what I mean? And like, but I didn't have Paddy Kilty with me every day telling me what to do.
And also, isn't it quite nice that you did your life as a stand-up comedian, your career as a stand-up comedian was award-winning.
Yeah. Sold out the Bloomsbury Theatre.
Yeah, you've never had a night where they didn't laugh. You peaked.
I kind of, the whole thing. So yeah, good. You're right, absolutely. I hit the jackpot. I can move on from there. Didn't sell out the O2, but, you know, it doesn't matter. It was, it was a surreal day because I'd been given this award by Tesco's that lunchtime. Tesco Mum, Celebrity Mum of the Year or something. I think basically they just have lots of mums of the year and they want somebody off the telly to come for the, it was lovely, a lovely lunch. And I'd taken the kids with me to that because, I mean, I wouldn't have got it if it wasn't for them, right? So I took them along and they loved it as well. And we had this really lovely lunch. And then I sent them home while I went off to the Bloomsbury Theatre to do this comedy and came home with it. And I said that night, I said to Kenny, this is like, you know, all these different facets of you as a person, kind of like in one day, kind of being, you know, kind of coming into sharp focus. And I guess that's, you know, I was just on the edge of being 40. And I suppose that's the start of where I really started to feel like, well, you can be lots of things to lots of people. And it's okay to not please everybody all the time, but it's nice to make a few of them laugh some of the time.
And I guess also it's that thing of getting yourself to a stage in life and then going, but I wonder what happens if I try that. I've never done it.
Yeah.
What happens? And I suppose that sets the tone for things you're still doing now.
Yeah. And if it doesn't work,
it's
not the end of the world. What's the worst thing that can happen? And I suppose also showing my kids that it's okay to laugh at yourself, you know, because a lot of the gags were obviously at my expense. And I don't want them to feel that, you know, that they couldn't try things. So it was a lesson in that as well. Although they're so competitive, for them it was all about the trophy. but did you bring a trophy home? It's, you know, now I'm 50, God, I mean, you know, there's no I'm not going to change back, I don't think, and be somebody that says no in case I fail. I think that's pretty much the template for the rest of my life now.
Yeah, I don't see that in your future at all. I think it's going to continue to be a series of exciting adventures for sure. Thank you so much, Gabby.
Thank you, Sophie. It's been lovely to chat.
I'm not kidding about the leotards. I can go and show you some really funny ones.
Well, I've still got boxes I could probably send you for your shows, you know, that you'd...
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. I say I have, but my mum, we were talking about kids leaving home, my mum sent boxes and boxes of stuff to my house when I was about 24. I was like, what are you doing? She went, I'm moving you out. And so they're probably somewhere in my attic, actually.
Okay. Well, if there's a job lot, auction, bid, I'll do you. Yeah, 20 quid for the lot.
The die was more than that.
Sorry, okay. Make it 25.
Thank you.
What a wise woman, eh? Such a lovely conversation. And I hope our paths cross again soon because I really liked talking to Gabby. I thought she was brilliant. And actually, I don't know when it's going out, but I spoke to her for her podcast as well, so you can catch that. I'll share that with you when I've done that, when that's published. And in the meantime, well, just kind of wish me luck here, really. I feel like today I've very much got like lockdown head, which is a feeling I haven't had for ages, but where I'm trying to do things and there's just my headspace is a bit crushed. And I'm feeling good about life. Like there's lots of reasons to be cheerful and I'm so excited about the things I'm doing this year. But I also feel like I just need everything to settle. You know what? I know this is going to sound insane, but having all this lovely stuff with murder has actually also made me feel a little bit weird. I think I'm very British and I'm very good at dealing with the kind of like pootling along. And then whenever things kind of have an acceleration, it makes me feel a bit icky. So like sometimes Richard will start being like, oh my gosh, I've just seen that the song's doing this on this chart or it's this on this. And I'm like, you have to stop talking about it now. I can't actually listen to it. It's like making me feel weird. And I think that's probably quite British of me, isn't it? What else was I going to say to you? I'm starting songwriting next week. Well, I've done one or two sessions, but I'm basically back in the studio making a new album. This is what I really wanted. I can't wait. I'm ready. I'm so ready. And I want to write some really happy, strong pop dance that's really for where I'm at in life as well. So let's see what that looks like. To be quite honest, I'm not entirely sure, but I'm going to have a go. Anyway, in the meantime, keep safe, keep happy, and I will speak to you again this time next week if you're still free. More lovely women coming your way. And in the meantime, yeah, take care. All right, off to go and deal with the smalls. All right, speak to you later. Thank you. Bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Tsunis.
I'm Kayla Tsunis and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.